All right, we're back. Before we go on to our Greg Palast interview, I wanted to reiterate some of the names of various health-related organizations, some of which Vicki Wilson mentioned in her interview. We would refer you for more information to Planned Parenthood, perhaps first and foremost. Planned Parenthood does an excellent job of getting out information online and directly about issues of safe sex and abortion. The National Abortion Federation, the NAF. The NAF is an organization dedicated to preserving and enhancing the quality and accessibility of abortion services. We would also recommend that you look up the website for CARAL, C-A-R-A-L, the California Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League, as well as the national organization, NARAL, N-A-R-A-L. Other sites you may want to check out are Catholics for a Free Choice, the Kaiser Family Foundation, and the Alan Guttmacher Institute. That's G-U-T-T-M-A-C-H-E-R. The AGI apparently provides reliable, balanced, nonpartisan information on abortion, contraception, and childbearing. We got word last week from Dr. Andy Jones of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour, the show that precedes us every week, every Wednesdays at 5 o'clock, that the possibility was arising to interview Greg Palast regarding his book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which has been on the New York Times bestseller list. Thanks to Dr. Andy's lead, we were able to contact Mr. Palast's publicist, Eileen Proctor, and conduct the interview last Friday, which we will, of course, air for you now. Greg Palast is a native Californian. He is currently an investigative journalist for BBC Television and the London's Guardian and Sunday Observer newspapers. These are the world's only major newspapers owned by a not-for-profit corporation. Palast's current bestseller, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, includes fascinating and hard-hitting examinations of Election 2000, the energy scandal and how Enron and others bilked California out of billions, the curious protection of the Bin Laden family by the Bush family. I don't know if any of you caught Terry Gross on National Public Radio on Tuesday, but she interviewed Dan Brighty, who's the author of the book The Iron Triangle, about the Carlyle Group, the 11th largest defense company in America, which curiously numbered among its membership both the Bush family and the Bin Laden family. The report that Greg Palast did on this issue, I would refer you to the NPR website if you'd like to catch that interview. I think it's worth hearing. But Greg Palast broke the story in 2002, a story which won him the California State University School of Journalism's Project Censored Award for that year, on the blocking of the investigation of the Bin Laden family by the Bush administration. This is talked about as well in The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Greg Palast, welcome to Radio Parallax. You were the first reporter to publish an expose of the purging of voter rolls in Florida. And I think it might surprise some people in reading the book to know that you had that in story in print 18 days after Election 2000, when Al Gore's fate was, you know, still hanging in the balance. So could you tell us a bit about how you caught wind of that story?
Yeah, well, what it was, I discovered that Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush had knocked off over 57,000 voters off the voter rolls just before the election. And it turns out that most of these people, the voters, were, surprise, African-Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And now the excuse was that they were felons, evil people who are not allowed to vote in Florida. In fact, it turns out that almost every single one was quite innocent of anything except voting while black. That's how your president was elected. That I reported from Britain within 18 days of the damn election. He had Al Gore still in the race.
Right.
And well, the rest is hysteria.
Yeah. Of course, taking out 57,000 supposed felons, the preponderance of them being black, you know darn well that 90%+ of the voters in Florida were going into the Gore camp.
That's right, of those voters, that's correct, over 90% of the black voters. And they, you know, the game continued on. I also found, you know, over 50,000 people who were denied registration in the first place. And I got the documents. That came out of Jeb Bush's office. I got the documents that were purged. He had actually cleaned his files, or his minions had cleansed all the state files of all the incriminating letters. and replaced them with other letters, and I got the originals. Now, in the good old days, when we had a Justice Department, you know, it would have been obstruction of justice.
Right.
But I'm not waiting for John Ashcroft to, you know, to cuff Jebby Bush or read Catherine Harris for rights.
Well, you you do publish both the pictures of the I guess it's the 2000 instructions to the registrars, and then the subsequent revised version that would look a lot better in court.
Yeah, well, see, one thing you'll find in my book, and the book's a lot of fun to read because it has, I get all these inside documents. It's not just about the elections, obviously. You're talking about, I got inside documents from the World Bank, you know, for those of you who believe that you know, the captains of industry and our political chiefs and the media moguls get together to divide up the world. I actually have the minutes of those meetings, right? And it's pretty strange. It's like the black helicopters fantasies come to life, but it's true. And so I got the documents. I reproduced them in the book. And just for fun, I also, if you know Winston Smith, who is the illustrator for the Dead Kennedys, he's done a collage for the beginning of each chapter.
I had not noticed that. I'm thumbing through it right now. Oh yeah, no, that's quality artwork.
Yeah, so I just the hippest artist I could find to throw that in with the documents. So the idea is to expose these little suckers and tell the truth on them and show you the documents and, you know, lots of different stories. You know, there's the election story, there's the World Bank, the real story, the Exxon Valdez, and then I also have a chapter on the idiocy of living in a small town.
Yeah, that was a good one. Let's do the election first, because we're 2.5 years out, and yet it's still reverberating in the country, issues of legitimacy of the government.
You betcha, and I'll tell you why. Tomorrow I'm going to, that is Saturday, I'll be in Birmingham, Alabama, with Martin Luther King III,
mm-hmm.
where they're celebrating the 40th anniversary of the big civil rights march from Selma to Birmingham that was the keystone of the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
And 40 years on, we're asking the same damn question. Can black people in America vote? And before, they used to have to worry about, in his daddy's time, Martin Luther King II, Jr., worried about poll taxes, night riders, and literacy tests that kept the black people from voting. But now they have to worry about characters with computers that will keep them from voting.
Well, you talk in the book about going into the Leon County, election officials, and they demonstrate for you that if you mark a ballot incorrectly, it spits it right back out.
Right.
In many Florida voting machines, but you point out that perhaps not coincidentally that nearby Gadsden County, 52% black,
right.
they rigged the machine so that it would simply eat the ballot and invalidate it. No one would know.
Think about that. What that means is that in white counties, every vote was counted. In black counties, any vote that had a stray mark on it was thrown away.
Sure.
You had thousands. There were 180,000 ballots simply not counted, simply thrown away in Florida. And most of those ballots were ballots from black people. Now, you tell me who won.
Yeah.
You tell me who won the election.
Well, Florida officially went to George Bush by 537 votes. And I didn't realize that you taught statistical analysis at the college level before you were an investigative reporter.
Yeah, unfortunately, I've had some grim experiences in my life. That was one of them.
Well, my question is, give me the best estimate. How many votes when it's all said and done, how many votes were shifted out of the Gore column by the actions of Catherine Harris, Jeb Bush, and the Choice Point Company?
I figure minimum of 90,000.
Out of Gore column, 90,000.
Out of that Gore lost 90,000 votes.
So that was 1.5% of the total vote.
Yeah, I mean, when you're talking about if you're looking at voters that were stricken off the voter lists, voters that were not allowed to register that should have been allowed to register, almost all of them were Democrats. The fixed voter machines and other cute methods of suppressing the black vote and to some extent suppressing the Jewish and greatly, very much the Hispanic vote was really suppressed as well through illegal means. You put it all together, it's around 90,000 votes.
Wow.
It's minimum. And, you know, these guys are good at this.
Yeah.
These guys are good at this.
You have some tongue-in-cheek references in the book, too. I hope tongue-in-cheek, mention of stealing the election of 2004.
I wish it were tongue-in-cheek, but that's not where the tongue is going right now. The problem is that they're getting ready. That's why I'm going down to Birmingham with Martin Luther King III.
Yeah.
We're launching a petition drive to prevent the disenfranchisement of black voters again in 2004. They're worse. They're getting worse. They got something weirdly, unbelievably called the Martin Luther King Voting Reform Act of 2002.
Uh-huh.
That's being used to actually disenfranchise black voters.
Well, the scariest thing to me is the idea that in the wake of Florida and so-called pushing for election reforms, we're going to make voting in some places all electronic, which means there's no way to go back and manually do a recount.
Well, there would be. I mean, if you had some type of printout that you could verify whom you voted for, et cetera, that would help. Then you put that in the lockbox. That wouldn't be the answer. But, you know, we've got computer sciences professors out of Stanford trying to do a national petition, say, please don't do this. Don't gatesify the entire electoral process.
Yeah.
Because let me tell you, there's a creepy little bunch of political operatives who are in charge of those voter rolls.
Yeah, I'm worried about a 15-year-old hacker in Madison switching the election.
Well, yeah, exactly, picking your president for you. I mean, that's bad enough. But believe me, these guys have some guys who are more than 15 years old, and they got more than an iPad to bend the whole system.
Well, here in California, you have a very interesting chapter on the whole debacle here with the energy price gouging a couple years back.
You got it.
And you cite the fact that the fix of that is going to cost something like $2 billion a year for 30 years?
Yes. Basically, California was ripped off by a bunch of power pirates who are very close to the Bush family, by the way. Not that I'm letting the Clintons off the hook, because I got to tell you, one of the power companies that's been ripping off California is called Entergy Corporation of Little Rock, Arkansas.
Uh-huh.
And one of their old lawyers of a subsidiary is Hillary Rodham. Hillary the Rod, who is now my U.S. senator out of New York.
Uh-huh.
And the Clintons were in on it, and the Bushes were very close in on it because, obviously, the big power pirates, Enron, Reliant, which is the alias of a corporation called Houston Industries, El Paso Corporation of Texas, TXU, which means Texas Utilities. These are all big buds, the big, big donors to the Bush campaign. They literally got together in hotel rooms and said, here's how much we're going to charge these guys in California. Even beyond that, they fixed the system. I showed how they knew that the system was going to explode. I mean, they knew it in advance, and it blew up. They knew it would happen on day one, and it did. Bang.
Now, you were looking into Enron years before they were even a household name.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking at Enron since like the day they were born in 1986. You know, in fact, I just was, I have some film. I work for BBC Television. You know, I do these reports that you're not allowed to see in America. And by the way, if, you know, your listeners can see these television programs I do, which are too dangerous for U.S. TV.
Uh-huh.
I can do them. They can go to my website, www.gregpalast.com.
Yes.
And click on the left side of the homepage, Real Video. You can get my reports on Florida, on what's really happened to Venezuela, on the Bush payoff to his donor buddies, you name it. And obviously, you know, read the book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, because, you know, until Patriot Act 4 comes along, you can still read, right?
Well, we'll have to give that. I'll give it at the end of this program. I'll go back and give that web address again. Currently, you're, I think, in Harper's Magazine talking about Argentina and other events down in South America. Can you relate for our listeners what Rudolfo Taranio told you about how Argentina privatized its assets?
Yeah, they privatized. You see, the World Bank has been moving into countries like Panzer Division and telling them how to reorganize their economies. Lo and behold, the key for each nation, every nation gets the same plan, which includes privatizing all their industries, selling off their gas and water and systems, banks, oil companies, you name it. And guess who gets to benefit? Well, we take the example of Argentina. Enron Corporation picks up the gas systems, it picks up the water systems of Buenos Aires, raises water prices through the ceiling. In the case of gas system, in fact, 1988, 2 years after Enron is born, the public works minister gets a call from a guy who says, I'm the son of the vice president, George Herbert Walker Bush.
Right.
And the son of George Herbert Walker Bush says, you know, my daddy's about to become president. He'd just been elected. He was still vice president. And he said, you know, my daddy would really appreciate if you would give this gas system to our friends at Enron.
And you're pretty sure, by the way, that wasn't Neil.
It wasn't Neil because Neil actually knew the public works minister of Argentina. Neil's been mucking around and stealing what he can from Argentina long before any of his other brothers got in the game. And it turns out this was Brother Jeb who had made this this little call, at least from our information. That's how the game is played. But the World Bank has been marauding across the planet. And after destroying Argentina, I mean, people in Argentina are, you know, you had the richest economy in Latin America. Now you got doctors and teachers hunting for food out of garbage cans at night. That's
yeah.
the wonders of the World Bank. So when people are protesting in the streets, the anti-globalization protesters, they think that these guys are bad. They're worse than they could ever imagine.
You were there in the early days of the Chicago School with Milton Friedman and the Chicago Boys as they were putting together a lot of what's become, I guess, the gospel of the World Bank since then.
Yeah, the free market miracle was created at the University of Chicago, and I was in with that little evil little group with Milton Friedman, who was the kind of inventor of the free market mania. But I always thought, I have to say, even though I was in with them, I was kind of working undercover. What they didn't know is I was passing information back to labor unions in Chicago about what these guys are up to, except I didn't take them seriously. I thought, this is a bunch of right-wing fruitcakes. And the only guy that seems to be listening to them is this murderous general in Chile, Pinochet. And little did I know that within short order, Governor Reagan would become President Reagan and take this monstrous comedy of terrors across the planet.
Yeah.
So I was, again, undercover. See, I've done a lot of undercover work. That's the other thing. I'm an investigative reporter, which is something you can't do in the United States anymore. I mean, it's kind of against the law.
It seems to be a lost art.
Well, because people are scared. It's a way to career death. I mean, besides me, you got Seymour Hersh, who lost his job at the New York Times, and Bob Perry, another great, he's the guy who uncovered the Iran-Contra scandal. He lost his job at the Associated Press.
Yeah.
You just name it, man.
Gary Webb.
Gary Webb, I mean, just beaten senseless, and, you know, Pulitzer Prize winners run out of the industry because he won't shut up and drop a story. I'm in exile in London.
Are you back in New York? Or are you still?
I am still in electronic exile. That is, my reports are still only going out on BBC television. It's still the biggest network going out worldwide, but it's, on the other hand, it doesn't come into America. You know, that is my big problem.
Well, a couple of discussions that were kind of a lesser nature that I thought quite interesting in your book were Walmart was one of them. Could you share some data about what is now, I guess, the world's largest corporation?
Yep.
Particularly given they emphasize made in the USA, evidently falsely.
No kidding. What they do is that they have flags all over their store, American flags, and waving the flag, and they have big signs that say "Buy American," and what you'll find is I forgot the number right offhand. It's I think in the book, but it's roughly 90%+ of the items in the store are made abroad. And, you know, it's not just made abroad. I don't have a problem in buying something from Guatemala. I have a problem, though, the way that Walmart makes this stuff. They were using child labor. And you want to know who's covering for them? Sam Walton, the bloodthirsty billionaire who ran that company, hired someone he called My Little Lady. That's also Hillary Clinton, who was on the board of directors of Walmart Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
Giving them protection while they were being exposed for using child slave labor to make shirts for them.
Well, I'm glad that you're an equal opportunity finger pointer regarding both sides of the aisle here.
Yeah, I mean, well, unfortunately, there's, you know, it's bent in both sides. I mean, I'm not one of these people that says they're all the same, because they aren't. I mean, the Bush family has taken the mix of politics and their bank accounts down to a new level, I suppose. But what you get in the book is the real stories. I mean, that's the important thing. You get the information, and it's not done without humor, because, you know, I can't stand the dull, boring American way of writing journalism. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like this New York Times stentorian, this is the truth. They're lying in your face. and they make it sound so solemn. McNeil Lehr report, you know, half the news is fabricated or handed to them by corporate PR guys, you know.
Yeah.
And they sound like it's so important and so, and you know, so original. It's not. So I try to write with some humor and style. So when you read my stuff, you know where I'm at.
At Verify, I got a few more than a few chuckles out of reading your book.
Yeah, you bet.
And speaking of corporate PR, one final issue. I know your time is short, but you investigated the Exxon Valdez disaster and talk about that in the book and reveal to us that there's more to that story than a drunken captain.
Well, yeah, you know, it's the same old, it's another con. See, what they tell you is, you know what happened there, a drunken skipper, a guy drank too much, he ran the boat out to the rocks, like, you know, like kind of a drunk driver, right, like plowing into a tree. That's not what happened. He wasn't even at the helm. They had turned off the radar. Why? They turned off the radar because it was too expensive to operate it, to train people to run it. It's too expensive to maintain. So Exxon didn't bother. It hadn't had the radar on since the ship was launched 2 years before the breakup. Then they lied about having safety equipment. See, what they did was they told the government, they actually signed a piece of paper saying, we have all this safety equipment in case there's an oil spill out in the Prince William Sound where the boat broke up. I figured, well, damn, no one's going to go check out among the icebergs if there's a bunch of safety equipment. So when the ship hit, there was nothing there to contain the oil. We should have never even heard, even if the ship ran aground, we should have never even heard about that spill. It should have been contained in minutes.
Right.
It wasn't. And because they lied about that equipment. Because when Exxon speaks, they're lying. And that's what we're finding, is that these corporations lie as they breathe, and they don't tell you that. And you better look out, because we are under, you know, America's under attack. I agree. But, you know, these are the attackers. We are under biological attack, but it's not anthrax we have to worry about. It's Monsanto's genetically modified, food poisons. We are under chemical attack. What we have to worry about is Pfizer pharmaceuticals, and that they're going to sell us either contaminated drugs or heart valves that don't work. You got that story in there, too.
Yes.
America is under siege, but by a bunch of billionaires who have bought themselves a White House. And they got their smarmy little rich kid in there. You know, he's against affirmative action. Can you imagine George W. said no one should get their position except through merit?
Bush saying that's almost as big an irony as his administration bringing elections and democracy to Iraq.
The fix is in. At least if you read the book, go to the website, you'll get the you'll find out how it was fixed. But look out for 2004, man.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well, I appreciate this. You ended the book with an admission that much of what you uncovered is a bit depressing, but we do have the power to act and change things. And you have an excellent appendix there of what you describe one can read,
That's right.
Listen to, act on, join, or get in trouble with. So I hope a lot of our listeners will go out there and get in some trouble.
I remember when I was in college, yeah. I mean, I my finest hour was I went to jail during the war in Vietnam. And, so there's always something to do. You don't necessarily have to go to the can, but we can make some choices, and you don't have to be like your parents. You can do something.
Our thanks to investigative journalist and author Greg Palast for that most interesting little chat. I would highly recommend that you go to Greg's website, gregpalast.com, for more information. You can watch the film that he did of interviewing Clayton Roberts, Catherine Harris's elections division's chief, on one of these sites. I believe it's www.news.bbc.co.uk, if you can remember all that. Anyway, I think you can probably access it through Greg's site. I believe that's how I got a hold of it. This is some priceless footage you need to see of what happened when Greg went in 60-minute style to ask some pointed questions to Mr. Clayton Roberts. And he had some paperwork to back up the questions he was asking, which caused Roberts to basically tear off the microphone and flee on camera. This is definitely the Keystone Cops meets 60 Minutes. I'm your host, Douglas Everett. This is Radio Parallax. We must again take a break. We're running a bit long. This is KDVS 90.3 FM. Let's take a break.